case.
Welcome to the Commonwealth. I'm going to give a root for the Tristan Senior Assistant Attorney General for the Appellate.
Glad to have you, Mr. Anderson. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Sonia Weaver Roots. I represent the Tribe of Wilson. I would like to reserve about 5 minutes for the federal attorney's testimony. We're here on one particular issue, whether my client was compelled to have a jury trial in his jail uniform. And from the record you see, his attorney did argue that he was in his jail uniform. He went and described it was his green dressed in with black shoes and a wristband. And the judge dropped it down for him to be able to find some clothes. And the Commonwealth accurately says in the record is, I guess we have excerpts from the record as opposed to the record. I was not the attorney who was his attorney at trial court. I was appointed to the appeal. And the record was prepared, and this is the record that was prepared for me. But I think the record is complete in regard to this one particular issue. He says, I guess it's appendix page 6, the attorney objected to being in his jail uniform, and then again, they say that it's appendix 14 and appendix 16 over and over again, he asserts he does not want to be tried in his jail uniform. And on this particular day, a lady friend, I'm unsure as to who the lady friend is because he keeps mentioning her, as a lady friend, brought clothes to the court for him to wear that day. She also brought clothes earlier but was turned away because it was too soon. And on the day she brought clothes this day, they said that they rejected him because they thought that him was taped. And
well, now, let me ask you a couple questions about that. Number one, the hem on it obviously is an issue because of contraband.
Yes.
It seems to me that it would have been pretty easy to fix that problem.
Me too, as well. But I'm unsure if the record says, I know hem tape, you can iron hem tape in, or you can tape it with masking tape. If you can iron it in, it's hard to pry apart. So I'm unsure as to what they meant by that hem was taped.
Well, thank you for that, because I didn't know that. But it seems to me that issue is a little bit of a red herring. I just wonder how important it was. The other question is the identifiable nature of prison clothing. The judge said, he sits down there, said it's not identifiable as prison clothing.
Well, he says, I guess it's on appendix page 14, he doesn't know whether the jury is sophisticated enough to know what jail clothes are. What he says, and he says, I've been sitting here and I can tell you which jail people come from. And so he can look at whoever walks out and says where they come from. But
the U.S. Supreme Court case that governs this, I guess, in great measure, it actually had the property of, and it had a jail on it. You don't have anything like that.
I don't have it in the record. That's correct. I know what the jail uniform
is. Isn't that a big problem? The courts of appeals in the federal system following Estelle have said what appears to me to be quite obvious. It doesn't matter whether the judge knows what the green garb is. The question is, would a jury know it? Now, obviously, as in Estelle, if it said, property of the local jail across the back or the front, but there's no evidence of that here. For all we know, he's in scrubs that he just wears. I mean, people wear bizarre things to court. You know this from your experience. So, and to say this trial judge compelled against, in violation of the Constitution, him to wear jail clothes because it was prejudice him in the eyes of the jury, we need to know evidence that suggests the jury would identify his clothes, his green scrubs, as a jail uniform. But I read the record. I didn't see anything suggesting it, other than the guess that it might be.
Well, his attorney did say he is wearing, of course, the city jail.
He didn't say it to the jury. let me back up. Of course he was.
Yes.
The trial judge knew it. The lawyers knew it. He knew it. The question is none of that. None of that's relevant. The question is, would a jury know it? And in a spin on that is, do we defer to the local trial judge making that judgment based upon him seeing something that we can't see because we don't have a picture, we don't have any real description other than green scrubs?
Yeah, I don't think in this case you can defer to the trial judge because what you have is the attorney stated to the court. He may not have stated as sufficiently as it would have been necessary, but he did point out that they were jail uniforms, that it was green scrubs and what he had. He didn't say what was written up there. I know what's written up there, but it's not in the record. He didn't do it as well as he should have, but he did preserve the issue because...
My question is assuming for the sake of argument, and actually I don't need to assume it for the sake of argument, he was wearing, in fact, jail clothing.
Yes, sir.
The green scrubs were jail clothing from the local jail.
Yes, sir.
But what in this record tells us that a juror would likely come to that conclusion?
I think just by the argument that he was wearing them. I understand that it didn't say what it was, but when the judge says... that he doesn't know how sophisticated the jury is to determine whether it is or is not, leads to the question that they may be able to determine.
Well, to win this point, you've got to show it's likely that they would have. You can't show maybe there was a constitutional violation.
Well, I believe there was a constitutional violation. I believe that when the judge had these several different conversations with my client in regard to the jail clothes, and he says, told my client, you should have had someone bring the appropriate clothing. My client said, I did have someone bring the appropriate clothing. And they were turned away, and the judge said she should have come back with some more. My client's incarcerated. It's very hard for him to get items to wear to court and have them brought that day. And then,
my point is none of that is legally relevant unless a jury would likely look at his green scrubs and think to themselves, I don't think this guy is an ER tech. I think actually he came from the local jail, and that's the local jail uniform. If they're not likely to think that, it doesn't matter whether any clothes were brought to them.
That's correct, Your Honor. But it's, like I said, it's difficult because I know what the jail uniform looked like. I know what's written on it, but it was not said here in the record.
You didn't try this case?
No, I did not try this case.
On the question of securing alternative clothing, in the dissent at the Court of Appeals, Judge Humphreys says that Estelle makes it clear that if a defendant objects to facing a jury in jail attire, the burden is on the Commonwealth, not on the defendant, to demonstrate from the record that a reasonable opportunity to secure civilian clothes was made. Can you tell me, in Estelle, where you think that's the case?
No, Your Honor. The only thing I can tell you is that I think it's just that if he makes the objection, that should be enough. I didn't see in Estelle what the burden was on the Commonwealth. I understand the reasoning of the dissent in the Court of Appeals, because once he makes that assertion, it does become the Commonwealth to say, he was wearing, it wasn't identifiable, or he couldn't tell it was jail clothes. But I don't see where Acton specifically says that in that case, Your Honor.
Have you found it in any case? I mean, there's no citation in the dissent for the proposition, and Estelle is a gigantic shepherdizing opportunity. Have you found any case that reverses the ordinary burden of proof?
Yes, but
on Estelle.
Yes.
Okay.
And I said that. But
Ms. Roots, your restraint is admirable, so I want you to know that. All right. But I get the feeling that those scrubs had property of whatever jail on the front. And I know it's outside of the record, which may very well be an extraordinary problem with this case.
Yes.
Assume for a moment, for the sake of this argument, that it was not. You are suggesting that it was, and I don't doubt you, all right? But our record has no evidence that it was. How would a defense lawyer, I guess this is a question for Mr. Anderson, how would a defense lawyer ever find out if a juror knew those were jail clothes without letting that juror or any other juror know that he's in jail?
I don't see how you can do it. You can't hold the jury until after the court case is over to ask, did you know he was in jail? But during the course of it, I don't think it can be determined.
So in this case, presents the legal question of Scrubs with no identification, which it makes it different than Estelle.
Yes.
Given the case that we have before us, how do you remedy it? How do you determine, how does a lawyer handle the case to find out whether or not a juror knows that these are jail clothes?
Aside from asking him, I don't know.
And if you ask him, you have let the cat out of the bag.
Yes, but here he also had on the bracelet that's identifiable from the Portsmouth City Jail, according to what his attorney did say.
Well, why would the trial judge say from the bench, I don't think the jury has enough sophistication to know these are jail scrubs or whatever, if the inference you're asking us to draw outside the record were true? That sounds quite bizarre. A trial judge, particularly one that's been in that jurisdiction for decades and knows a lot about the local jail uniforms.
Judge Sword is he was having a discourse with my client from the record that was not a very pleasant discourse. And
well, from the record I reviewed, I understand why. From the judge's perspective, he ultimately held that this was a pattern of bad faith on the client's part.
He did, but that's where I said I took exception to that, because the clothes were brought that day. And they said they dropped it down, but you look at the very front of the transcript, and it starts at 10:15 is when the transcript starts. So as far as determining how much time he was given to have someone bring more clothes to him that would be appropriate, it's difficult, because all it says is we took a recess and we started back. But the transcript starts at 10:15.
Well, if the truth is, and I'm not assuming anything in my question either way, that it said flat out, I just came from the jail, big on the front of the thing, and everybody can read it, and no one can explain the trial judge's contrary remark. But if that were the truth, there's going to be a lot of witnesses to that, and that would be a pretty strong habeas case, because that is Estelle.
Yes.
So wouldn't that be the proper remedy for your inference outside the record in this kind of case?
No, I think that it's very hard when you have a record that we have that was made. But I think that with the fact that he was wearing the jail uniform, and I know they just call it the jail uniform, and there's green scrubs with black shoes and a wristband, I think that would have been sufficient to note his objection, to let it be known that he's wearing the jail uniform without getting into exactly what everything says. Because I know, based on what Mr. Rosenberg said, he represented him, he said there is a case out there that says I have to object to him being in his uniform, and he just didn't go on to explain it.
And Ms. Roach, you want to save some time. You have 3 minutes left.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. On Justice Lemon's questions about how would the juror know, I would simply direct the court to a couple of cases I've cited on brief. I think the short answer to your question is, if it's in the record as to what the person's clothing was, you conclude from that a juror would reasonably have inferred that that's prison garb. I cite at page 21 of my brief, this is Smith v. United States, it's an 8th Circuit case. The defendant stood, quote, out in the courtroom wearing his bright orange shirt and pants, and therefore it is virtually certain that jury members would identify the orange outfit worn by Smith as prison garb. Then a case from Texas, 2002, quote, juror who saw a defendant in orange overalls marked P5, P6, number 27, number 25 would likely surmise the defendant was wearing jail clothing. So I think
that's not our case.
I understand that. Yes.
Well, that's the whole point. The whole point is that somebody wasn't wearing orange, at least on the record. These are described more like hospital scrubs. So what do those things have to do with it?
Well, then, that's my whole point. Because we don't have equivalent clothing here, the conclusion therefore obtains that the jurors would not likely have surmised that it was jail clothing.
How does a defense lawyer answer that question satisfactorily at voir dire?
You mean, well, First of all, there's no voir dire here. That's one of the problems with the record. I have no idea what was even asked.
You, of all people, know that we don't have one case in front of us. We have hundreds of cases in front of you. All right, so how does a lawyer handle this problem at voir dire?
If there's something that, I think it would depend partly on just how glaringly obvious or not so glaringly obvious that what the person's wearing might be perceived as jail clothing.
You still haven't answered my question. The question is, the guy comes in there and scrubs. The record is that there's nothing in there that says property in a local jail. All right? He's concerned that everybody in the community knows that the jail houses people in scrubs. How does the lawyer find that out on voir dire without informing the jury that he just came from the jail?
Yeah. How does he say if you conclude that this person's wearing jail clothing, how would that affect your ability to hear this case? Well, I'm not sure. It's never been raised as an issue here. I'm not sure exactly how he would go into it. I do know that there are cases where someone is tried for a crime they committed in prison, so, and Estelle mentioned it itself, that there's no issue there as to why they might be wearing jail clothing. I'm not entirely sure what the person would ask on.
The best, really, defense counsel could ever do, they would, as the chief's questions rhetorically asked, obviously the defense counsel is not going to, you know, raise the issue in voir dire. I mean, what is required is a proffer, and an accepted proffer.
And the one of the problems here is this record is so inadequate. We have no voir dire. We have the penalty phase is almost non-existent. There could, for example, I've cited a case where a cautionary instruction was given to the jury before deliberation saying the fact that this person is in jail clothing is something that you can't consider as proof of guilt. For all I know, that was done here. But the record is totally devoid. The penalty phase is there's almost nothing in there. And these uncertainties certainly, surely not, should not be resolved against the appellee. The record here, I've done a lot of appeals. I've never seen a first page of a trial transcript that starts like this. The cover page says excerpts of trial transcript, and it might as well started out with the first words on the first page with the judge saying, well, what did you find out? I mean, there was obviously all sorts of things that went back and forth between the judge and the defense attorney, and we don't know exactly what happened. We don't know what sort of reasonable opportunity was afforded this defendant. I mean, there's the expression, you don't know what you don't know. And we have just many, many uncertainties. I mean, counsel herself today in the oral argument has acknowledged uncertainties. I don't see how the court can intelligently decide this case, which after all Estelle says is essentially a case-by-case determination, when there's so much uncertainty as to what actually transpired. But it's even more true that if you have all these uncertainties, how are they resolved against the appellee, the party that prevailed in the lower court?
Well, that appears to be the real rub here, because the difference between the majority and the dissent in the Court of Appeals is one thing, the burden of proof. The majority placed the burden of persuasion and the burden of proving this violation on the appellant. The dissent placed the burden of disproving a violation on the appellee.
And I think Justice McClanahan asked about this in Estelle. I see absolutely nothing that puts some kind of burden on the Commonwealth. But the majority went beyond that. The majority says quite accurately, and I haven't heard defense counsel suggest to the contrary, there's this incomplete, truncated record on appeal, even though it's the appellant's duty in any case to provide an adequate record to dispose of the issues on appeal. And if you don't have a complete record, you simply can't know in the kind of way you need to know in order to do the case-by-case determination in Estelle whether or not there was compulsion. I mean, after all, Estelle itself said that there are sometimes that a defendant wears prison garb as a sympathy ploy. They pointed out in Estelle itself that the defendant there was 67 years old and he didn't really have much of a defense, and therefore it was a reasonable approach that he might have undertaken.
And sometimes defendants take the stand when they ought to remain sitting at counsel table. That doesn't make any difference at all. If he makes the choice, there's no question. He wants to wear prison clothes, great. What does it have to do with this case? He doesn't want to wear prison clothes.
According to the judge, judge made a finding of fact that this was part and parcel of his continuing stalling tactics, his obstructionist tactics. That was a finding of fact upheld by the Court of Appeals on appeal. The brief in this court has
well, that,
not...
That may be, and you might want to move to that, but what you just said has absolutely no application to this case. This man did not want to wear prison clothes. He did not want to wear prison clothes, which means that the rejoinder to the bench is inapposite.
Well,
and if you want to talk about what amounts to the court's findings that he's using this in bad faith as a stalling mechanism, that's legitimate.
Okay,
go
well,
for it.
In fact, if his assertion that he wants to wear jail clothing is done as part of his continuing actions done in bad faith, then in fact that negates the notion that he really truly wanted to be tried in some other clothing. If he says that as part of his bad faith, then we don't take that at face value as to what his true intentions were. Again, the factual finding of the trial of the Court of Appeals that the defendant had acted in bad faith, they said it was fairly supported by the record, it's not plainly wrong. That was never mentioned in any way, shape, or form in the appellant's brief in this court. In fact, the appellant's brief doesn't even refer literally once to the fact that there was even an appeal in the Court of Appeals. So I think that the Court of Appeals conclusions that the record such as it was did not show any compulsion, did not show that he was deprived of a reasonable opportunity to obtain suitable clothing, that he'd acted in bad faith, all those things go unmentioned in the appellant's brief in this court. I also submit that, particularly as to the guilt phase, this is, I think, hardly even arguable as to whether it was harmless error. And I say, first of all, Estelle itself, the seminal case here, makes clear, I think, that this kind of claim is subject to harmless error analysis, and that makes sense because it's not some unmitigated disaster, according to Estelle, that you are in prison guard. Sometimes it's a tactical ploy. So it's clearly subject to harmless error. I've cited probably 15 or 20 cases from other jurisdictions in which the courts have said it was harmless error. It was certainly subject to harmless error analysis, and in many of those instances, it was harmless error, based in no small measure on the overwhelming proof of the defendant's guilt. In this case, this is a recidivist shoplifting case. The evidence, there was one witness, he worked at a Walmart, I think it was. He saw the defendant directly put things in his pocket, conceal it, walk out, and he immediately follows him and says, you know, stop, why did you take those things? And the defendant says, give me a break, I'll give them back to you, just don't let me go. And then the defendant takes out these items. He has no receipt. If there was ever the clearest example of shoplifting, this is it. Patently to be harmless error as to the guilt phase. The
but
dissent,
may,
by
may
the way...
There, may there have been harm at the sentencing phase?
No. I think, although that's obviously a more plausible issue because inconveniently
five years,
for me...
5 years is a long time.
Right. Well, more to the point, it was a 1 to 5 year range of sentence and he got the 5 years. And obviously that's an inconvenient fact for me. I would say several things in response. First, and I cited a case from California, Bradford, that says flat out that in this context of prison guard, By the time you get to the penalty phase, the presumption of innocence, which is the key concern underlying Estelle in the first place, the reason that wearing prison garb is a matter of concern is that it may undercut the presumption of innocence. But by the time you get to the penalty phase, the presumption of innocence, by definition, is gone because the person's been convicted. And in the Bradford case...
The person's not convicted until there's a sentence.
Pardon?
The person's not convicted until there's a sentence.
Well...
You know that.
I understand, but the presumption of innocence is certainly gone.
So why is it gone? I mean, why is the presumption of innocence gone? It's simply because the evidence was overwhelming.
All I can tell you is that court, and I think several of others have said it just in the terms that I have, that by the time you get to the penalty phase, you've been found guilty, and the concerns about presumption of innocence certainly, at a bare-bone minimum, are not nearly as implicated as they are in the guilt phase.
This was a jury case, right?
This was a jury case. I would simply point out...
There was a verdict of guilty preceding the penalty phase.
Right.
So there was an actual finding, a verdict of guilty.
Right. Which seems to me the inescapable verdict. It is hard to imagine. How could they possibly have found, based on this evidence, anything other than guilt? And by the way, the dissenting judge in the Court of Appeals, if you accept his reasoning, you could never have harmless error in this kind of case because he said, well, there was only one witness. Well, so what?
The one witness was the defendant.
Pardon?
The one witness was the evidence of the defendant's actions.
Right, from the eyewitness who dealt with him directly. I mean, but it's almost as if the dissenting judge in the Court of Appeals wants to graft this two-witness perjury principle onto harmless error analysis. I've never seen a harmless error analysis where they said, well, there weren't enough witnesses, so therefore it can't be harmless error. But getting back to the penalty phase, which is clearly a more problematical issue for me, he got 5 years, which is the maximum. I would just simply point out several things. One, we have the penalty phase portion of the excerpts of the trial transcript are virtually not there. There's no, it's just basically, here's the verdict. We don't know what was said by way of opening statements, evidence, closing arguments. It's just totally in a vacuum. So we don't know whether or not the judge might have given a cautionary instruction to the jury in its deliberations. I've cited the case of Gager v. Commonwealth, which is one where presumption of innocence was not given, and this court held it was nevertheless harmless error in the guilt phase because the evidence was overwhelming, basically unchallenged, and it was unchallenged here, of course, in the guilt phase. And in the penalty phase, he got 1 year above the minimum, and they said that that was still harmless error. So given the fact he had five, according to the guilt phase, he had five prior shoplifting convictions. I think it's entirely unsurprising he got the result. If the court disagrees on that, then I think the court should do much as the U.S. Supreme Court did in the Virginia case of Turner and uphold the guilt phase and send back for resentencing. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Roots?
I don't believe that this is a harmless error situation. I understand the Commonwealth's position, but in this situation, he did ask several times not to try to appeal in the form, and the judge made mention that he thought it was a delaying tactic. And as I said before, and it's in my brief, I don't think it was a delaying tactic when he had clothes bought twice. They did not mention in the record whether the clothes that were brought the first time were appropriate or not. All we know is the clothes that were brought on trial day. Can be tried, they said, to him was taken. He had someone bring him. I don't know, and I don't think this would ever be on the record, what was said between the attorney and the client, or what's said in the hallway between the witness who brings the clothes and the attorney. That would never be on the record.
Ms. Roots, what do you make of the Commonwealth's argument that the discussion you were just now having with us is compulsion versus non-compulsion?
Yes, sir.
But suppose there was compulsion, suppose there was an identifiable jail uniform, the trial judge did nonetheless make a factual finding that the failure to produce the clothing falls into what he viewed as, quote, a pattern of trying to avoid going to trial. And the record of this case amplifies why he made that statement. The Commonwealth argues that you did not assign error to that point or even argue specifically the bad faith point.
I did not, because I didn't find it as a factual finding. I just thought it was the opinion of the judge who liked to talk on the record and said many other things on the record. So I read it. He always, I hate to say that, but he talks a lot and gives a lot of opinions, and that's what I took it as, because I've been in this courtroom several times. I didn't take it as a finding of fact. Maybe I should have.
That the defendant's motion was denied because his failure to produce appropriate clothing falls into what I view as a pattern of trying to avoid going to trial. That's just an off-the-cuff remark by a trial judge that talks too much.
That particular one. Sorry, I'm trying to be disrespectful.
Fair enough.
Because it was argued at some point earlier that he didn't want to be tried, and then he did it again, and then he reiterated at sentencing that he tried me in my jail uniform, and I didn't want to be tried in my jail uniform. And the Commonwealth talks about whether it would have made a difference at sentencing or not. It is up to 5 years, but you can get up to 1 day. It's from 0 months to 5 years in prison.
What about the Commonwealth's suggestion of uphold the guilt and send it back for another sentencing?
That could happen. It would work. I guess if
there was an error that was where harm occurred, can you make an argument, or would you make an argument, that the error at the guilt phase was not harmless, that somehow there was a defense at the guilt phase here?
Well, Your Honor, there could have been a defense, and I say it that way because my client chose or did not testify. And when he had the option to testify, he did not testify at the beginning. He said he smelled conspiracy. He thought there was a conspiracy going on against him, and that probably went to his consideration as to whether he would testify or not, and he was still in the jail uniform. I understand that happened one time.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talking in court in this case. I just am very curious. Did the lawyers talk like that on a regular basis in the Portsmouth Circuit Court?
Talk like what, their client that way?
Yeah.
No.
What about the defendant, the way he was talking to the judge? Sounded like they were in a locker room or something.
I know. That's just how my client talked to me as well.
Okay.
I'm not...
Well, I kind of understand how your client talks. I just don't understand how the lawyer talks. But having said that, it's not your burden to defend it.
That was part of the errors, but yeah. But that's not how we usually talk in court.
All right. I'm relieved to know that. Call the next case.